Sheila Anderson of the Arts and Humanities Data Service, speaking on how do we ensure that researchers know what is available to them.
The reason why I don't have any PowerPoints is because I sat down on Sunday afternoon and thought, I live in London, and I had intended to go and look around the open house. We have an open house weekend where you can go around and look at different architectural buildings, but it was such a grey and miserable afternoon, I didn't go, and I sat down instead to think and write this talk today. And I looked at the title for the first time properly. It's always dangerous when somebody asks you to give a talk and you say yes without really thinking about what they've asked you to talk about. Because I sat down and read the title, How Do We Ensure That Researchers Know What Is Available to Them? Well, how the hell do I know? If I did, I'd be a very rich woman. So I immediately had a problem. Now, I've sat and listened to some of the presentations today, and they've been really great presentations, and I'm very sorry that I missed most of yesterday's presentations, because I would like to have heard those. It's very clear. I can go and talk to people like Jonathan. Fantastic ideas in particular areas about where you find things. We can just go and search Google. We can go to A2A, we can go to the TNA, we can go to the BL, we can go to the DMB, we can go to Humble, we can go to Artifact, we can go to British History Online. There's a whole list of things that we might do and how we might do it. We can produce nice glossy publications like this which tell you what fantastic work we're doing. And we can go and talk at conferences and promote our things, and we can talk to our colleagues. And that's the end of my presentation, so I can sit down now. Thanks. But that seems to be a little bit of a waste of the slot that I've got available to me, so I'm afraid I'm going to carry on for a little bit longer. And instead, what I wanted to do was sort of speculate on the kind of infrastructure that we need. It isn't possible ever, I don't think, for us to ensure that we know that we can allow researchers to know what's available to them. It's unknowable. We don't know today what is available to us. I don't think we've ever known what's available to us. We've got some idea of what there might be, but there's an awful lot of things that we don't know. And part of the joy of doing humanities research is uncovering new things and discovering new things. And I don't think we should lose sight of that. So in the digital age, what does that mean for us? And I want to bring back in the concept of infrastructure that Lorna alluded to in her talk yesterday, and talk a little bit about the concept of the cyber infrastructure, as it's so delightfully called. 2004, the Atkins NSF report in the US talked about creating a cyber infrastructure for the science community. And this is a great report if you can ever get around to reading it. Summarising a 180-page, I think it is, report in about three or four lines, I think what they did was envisage the cyber infrastructure as complex but with a level of real coherence. Some things would be concentrated in particular places and centres of expertise and organisations, but it would also be highly distributed in a number of different ways. That it would build on relative strengths, and it would involve a large number of disciplines, institutions and organisations. So I wanted to think about that concept of infrastructure, cyber infrastructure, and what that might mean for the arts and humanities. Now, fortunately, John Unsworth has just done a report for the ACLS talking about a cyber infrastructure for the arts and humanities, and I'm going to pinch a couple of his ideas during the course of my talk. He identified it as having two layers, a technical infrastructure, which is about middleware, applications, exchange protocols, access mechanisms, search engines and so on, computing power. And he argues that much of this can be shared across the arts, humanities, social sciences and sciences, that we can borrow and steal from each other, that we can supply things for each other. We don't have to build this kind of thing on our own. That there would be some variation, of course, that would be particular to our disciplines and to our requirements, but that a lot of it was common across us. And then there was an enabling infrastructure. And that enabling infrastructure was about institutional policies and organisations. It was about things like IPR, copyright, privacy, governing access and use. It's about standards, technical and metadata standards for data creation and so on, some of the things that Simon was talking about. It's also about strategic data creation, making difficult decisions and bringing on board some of the things that Seamus was talking about. And perhaps most importantly, it's also about the human being. It's about the people involved, and it's about expertise and training. So what I decided to do instead was to reframe the question that I've been given and to say, what kind of arts and humanities cyber infrastructure do we need to enable users to know four things? Firstly, to know what's available to them, or to at least be able to find out some of the things that might be available to them. But also, how can they access that? And then how can they investigate that content? How might they use it? How might they embed it in their research? And I don't think you can separate those out from one another. I think we have to start seeing this as a coherent whole, and we have to start planning it as a coherent whole. The arts and humanities already has an infrastructure that's been built up over centuries. We've already got a foundation of diverse collections of primary sources that's held in libraries, archives, museums, galleries, but it's also in private collections. And I've been struck by how increasingly the digital age has encouraged the use or the creation of private collections through genealogical research and through other types, local history and family history and so on, all those kinds of things. We have bibliographies, we have abstract services, we have catalogues and citation systems, we have standards in which they work, we have concordances, and we have finding aids that make information findable and retrievable. And we do have standards embodied in cataloguing and classification systems. And we have a whole body of professional people, librarians, archivists, curators, who can link the operation of this structure to the scholars who use it. And then, of course, we have the scholars ourselves, who know and understand primary source materials, who know how to interpret, who know how to use things, who know how to find things. You know, it's what we've been doing for centuries. We don't need to reinvent the wheel necessarily. And I want to think a little bit more about the nature of the source materials. And again, I think these are things that have started to come out in this conference, sort of talking about beyond digitization. What we have are source materials that are disparate. They're most usually created for purposes that have nothing to do with the research purpose for which we may wish to use them. They're highly fragmented and distributed in seemingly random institutions and organisations. Often things can end up in archives for no particular reason. Sometimes they clearly can. I mean, the National Archives has a clear mission. But often things end up in private papers because you happen to have gone to that institution as an undergraduate and you will your private papers to that institution. Or another institution happens to have enough money to be able to purchase your private papers, perhaps. These materials will then be curated and managed to different standards. They'll be described to different standards using different kinds of metadata. And sometimes they won't even be catalogued and described at all, other than with perhaps the most rudimentary entries. And again, we have this increasing volume of individual, community-based, group-based materials ably highlighted by Louise and Michael's papers this morning. But what digitization offers us, I think, is the application of an infrastructure that can start to reunite these records, that can start to connect the disparate parts and to make the resulting whole available over the network, and that can also do the kinds of things that Seamus was talking about, can select different parts or perhaps resources that are held in different places and perhaps been created for different purposes but have a similarity for the research purposes that we want to use. And we can use the digital world to bring those together. And that's starting to happen. Harold yesterday in his paper, Harold Short, was talking about second and third generation resources. And I think that was sort of important points that he was making there about the collaborative nature of this work, about the distributed nature of a lot of this work. Good example, perhaps, another good example, we've heard lots of good examples through this conference, you know, the Perseus project. It calls itself an evolving data library, and its goal is to bring together a wide range of resources. It has key aims. It has a distinct purpose for what it wants to do. It wants to strengthen the quality of questions. It wants to lead to new avenues of research, and it wants to connect more people through the connection of ideas. I mean, these are lofty goals and aims, but they're very successful, and people know about this resource. The AHRC, since 1999, over £100 million that's been spent on research grants and resource enhancement grants and projects, over half of those have had some kind of digital output. So even within the academy, we're actually producing, I mean, this is just from the AHRC, there's obviously the Wellcome Trust, there's Leverhulme, there's other funding bodies, we've had a lot of money put in from the NOF funding projects, JISC has been funding data creation as well. So we've got a whole body of material that's starting to develop there. But a lot of this funding, as well as going into projects like Perseus and the more sort of second and third generation, a lot of funding is for smaller scale digitisation projects. Often they will have an online web interface that will enable users to find and navigate through the content. But again, they'll have different metadata and technical standards. And in some senses, a lot of that is replicating the distributed nature of the analogue materials. I'm not sure how far this is helping us to build the sort of data library of the world to bring all this material together, because they sit there, a few people know about them, a few people use them, and then nobody else knows about them. And we're in danger, I think, of ending up with a plethora of unsustainable and invisible websites if we're not very careful. But I don't think that that's the only issue that a cyber infrastructure needs to address either. It isn't just about access and how do we find the digital. A recent British Academy report authored by Karen Spark-Jones, e-resources research in the humanities and social sciences, argued very strongly the case that humanities researchers like analogue stuff as well as digital stuff. We like books. We like paper. We like going to archives. And we have to think about how we can start to bring together the digital with the analog. And we have to have finding aids, and we have to have an infrastructure that can support access to both of these things, that can enable us to find a digital resource, but then might also enable us to find a collection that's still in paper form, sitting in an archive that we might want to look at, that can link us to scholarly publications that is about the particular subject, the particular area that we're looking at. So it isn't just about how do we access the range of digital stuff, it's also about how do we access the range of analogue stuff, but tie that together with the digital. Now, the British Academy report recommended prioritising digitisation of catalogues in libraries and archives. But they also recommended doing that as a quick and dirty exercise. Now, they're my words, not their words, not Karen's words. But it was a quick and dirty exercise. Get it catalogued, get it out there in a way that users need it. Let's not worry too much about library standards, about making sure that we have the dots after Great Britain so that we're following AARC2 rules. Let's just get it out there and get it catalogued. Now, this is quite a difficult concept, I suspect, for a lot of library and information professionals to accept, but I do think this is something we've got to be thinking about. But Karen also recommended that this should have guidelines on how this might be done, so that we were following these guidelines. And there was a further interesting finding from the British Academy report. There was some talk about the use of Google, and a very high proportion of us use Google. It's often our first stop. Let's go and search Google and see what we can find. But it was very clear that researchers were concerned about the quality of the located resources that they found through Google. So we have to think several on several layers here. We have to think about having standards and good practice. framed and formulated for our communities so that we know what we're doing, and certainly what we're producing has some kind of quality standards. There's a hell of a lot of good work going on in this area through data services like the AHDS, through a number of the AHRC-funded research centres who are producing guidelines in their particular areas, and lots of other bodies as well working in this area. So we need to think about how we can start to bring that work together into a more coherent whole, how we can start to coordinate some of the efforts that are going on here, and how we can promulgate their use through a wider community. And Tim Hitchcock talked yesterday about resources being, again, my words, fit for purpose, targeted at users. And I think he made an interesting point about following the same principles as for conventional publications, not forgetting the lessons that we've learned when we're conventionally publishing things, bringing that over into the digital process. So that brings up issues about quality control. It brings up issues about peer review. Do we need to think about peer review process for digital resources? And if we do, what does that mean? How do we do that? And how do we then bring together the technical and the intellectual? And I think that was what Alistair was touching on in his talk this morning. I think that fortunately there is a project funded under the AHRC ICT programme to start to address this area, and I'm really looking forward to the outcomes of that particular piece of research. Some of the other things that we need to be thinking on. Copyright and IPR. We've got to have a robust and flexible framework that enables us to access and use resources with confidence. We've got to be able to know that we can take something and that we can use it and that we can do things with it. And we've got to know the limit of what we can do and what we can't do. And that applies right from the very beginning about rights clearance right through to the end user. There's things like the Creative Commons initiative that has come out of the States and been taken up within the UK as well through the BBC and other organisations. How could we think about using something like Creative Commons that gives us a very clear indication about what we can and can't do with the resources that we do manage to find? We need sustainable and professionally preserved resources that enable us to use and to link to resources with confidence. So that we know if we use something, it's still going to be there if we need to go back to it, or if somebody wants to validate our research and wants to go back to it in 5 years' time. We've got to make sure that can happen. And I think that raises something that I didn't have in my sort of walkthrough of what I was talking about, but has certainly come out from the discussions today. If we're increasingly using resources that are being created by family historians or by community groups, who's going to take responsibility for those resources to make sure that they're still available for us in the future? And I was fascinated by Michael's paper and the way that he's using resources that have been created by individual researchers looking at their family histories and using those as evidence for his own research. I mean, that offers fantastic opportunities that wouldn't have been available to us to do. But does have a number of issues, I think, in terms of authenticity, in terms of accuracy, and in terms of sustainability of that material in the longer term. We need indexing, searching, and filtering tools that can be thrown at huge volumes of data and information that's available on the internet. And we need those so we can organise and make sense in a variety of ways. Discipline-based, data type-based, all kinds of different ways. There's a lot of work going on in this area, and we need to think about how we're going to apply them. And I think as a community of researchers, we have to say what it is we require from those kinds of tools. What do we require from them? What do we want them to index and search? And again, Richard's paper this morning talking about ontologies and the difficulties of ontologies. We need to start to grapple with those things if we're going to really seriously deal with the mass of information that's available to us. And then, of course, we need the search engines to discover and access the data resources. But not only text-based. Search engines at the moment are primarily about putting in keywords, and they're about going off and finding pieces of text or finding text that are related to images or related to sound or related to moving images. We need to put more effort into image-based retrieval. Again, there is some interesting work going on there, but also about retrieval from moving images, moving pictures, and from sound resources, so that we can speak into our computer what we want and then be able to retrieve things back that sound like the words that we've put in or the sounds that we've made. So we need to expand what search engines can do. So we need a cyber infrastructure that can create for us an integrated and interoperable domain of e-resources where any researcher can easily discover and access resources of different origin and from different places, can combine and link those resources of different kinds, and then can apply advanced functions for analysis and understanding. That's all then. That's simple. That's next year's work. But we are making progress. There are initiatives. There's initiatives to enrich and integrate catalogue information. And increasingly, our colleagues in information and computer science are creating automated techniques that will enable us to mine information from resources that removes the need for us as human beings to create so much structured information. And we've got to work with them to create those kind of tools that will enable deep, rich mining of the content that's on the internet. We need to virtually merge archives and think about how we can use grid-type applications to do that. And I'm very pleased to see that the AHRC is going to fund an e-science programme that will see something like £1.2 million for projects over the next 3 or 4 years, plus some postgraduate studentships. And I think that's an important move forward. It's been a disappointment that we've been left behind to a certain extent because we didn't get the funding, not being a research council at the time, the AHRV, as was, didn't get the research funding that the social sciences and the sciences received, the millions of pounds, to create their infrastructures. We are starting to see the development of generic schemas for different classes of documents. So that we can have structural interoperability between them, so that we can select particular pieces of information from documents or particular documents and bring those together virtually, so that we don't have to have everything done. We can select the little pieces that we want and we can bring those together in a way that we want. But there's all the issues about context and provenance there that I think we also have to grapple with, that Louise so ably discussed this morning. There are moves to create semantic interoperability, at least in some areas, and there is work on ontology development, not only in history, there's also some work in archaeology, and the semantic web is holds a lot of promise but hasn't delivered too much just yet, but I think that's a watch this space and let's engage with it and see what we can get out of it. And then I think, in the UK in particular, we're very lucky in that we have a strong national background that can provide stable and persistent resource infrastructure. We have the JISC, and I think we're very fortunate to have the JISC. We have institutional repositories, we have the Methods Network, AHDS-RDN, we have increasingly a network of expert centres like CCH, like the Humanities Research Institute at Sheffield and so on, that are building up expertise. We've got the AHRC research centres that are building up expertise in particular areas, and we need to build on that backbone, that network, and we need to think about how we can support that network and that infrastructure in the longer term. We can't think about this as short term. We can't have short-termism here. This has to be longer-term thinking. We have to think what that backbone, what that infrastructure is going to be in the longer term, what form it needs to take. We've got the development of flexible web-based collaborative frameworks, some of which has been already talked about, development of web services, portals, and portal environments that will put a search engine onto the user's desktop. And I think that's quite important, that you just go to your desktop, you go through the institutional framework, and then you can search for your One of the things that struck me, I think, today was, oh, look, there's this fantastic resource, there's that fantastic resource, there's that fantastic resource, and you have to know where they are, and then you have to go to them, and then they all search differently, and I think that causes us problems. We've got to think about how we can bring those together onto the user's desktop environment. And we need to think about how we use Google to make content, but also quality mark and accessible. And importantly, I think, we need to rethink the role of the library in all this. Thinking about virtual libraries. Simon pointed out to me how much subject librarians can do for people. We need to think how we can tap into the expertise of the subject librarian, but do that in a virtual way. Do that in a way that responds to the users and have that as a user-driven. And I think there's a big debate to be had about the future of the library and how that's taken forward. So, I think, to summarise, there is a lot of progress, but equally this is quite a grand vision. This is quite a long-term process to create this infrastructure that we want. And it requires strategic thinking. And certainly, I think we'll all be looking to the AHRC to provide us with that strategic thinking, to provide us for strategic planning and strategic resourcing. And we need the time to be able to do that, and we need the time to be able to think through what these things are. And it needs to be driven by our needs, and it needs to be carried forward by our imaginations. Thanks.